for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2022, and this is episode 294, which is a conversation about the debate in evangelicalism over the existence of Adam and Eve in Genesis. Today's guest is Dr. Casey Luskin, who is an attorney with graduate degrees in science and law. Dr. Luskin works as Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture for the Discovery Institute. He's also a co-founder of the Intelligent Design and Evolution Awareness Center. Casey has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article in our new print edition, Volume 45, Number 1, is called Lessons Learned and Not Learned from the Evangelical Debate Over Adam and Eve. Subscribers can read his article in the newest print edition. If you would like to subscribe, please go to our website, equip.org. And this is the final few days of our very special promotion to help us with our fiscal year end for our journal. So we want to give you these great deals. For your gift of $30 or more to our ministry, you can receive a subscription, and that retail value is $33.50. For your gift of $55 or more, two subscriptions. For your gift of $75 or more, three subscriptions. And for your gift of $100 or more to help us with our fiscal year end, you can receive four subscriptions. And that would be a great way to gift some friends or your pastor or other church staff this very helpful resource. And in addition, not only will you get four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more, you will receive one copy each of two hardcover books, which is the best articles from our archive. One is called What is Truth? And the other is called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals? And now back to the podcast. Casey, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Melanie.
Well, Casey has written for us over the years, and so it's great to have him for the first time on this podcast. And as our listeners know, we have had some recent conversations about the historical Adam and Eve on the podcast, but I want to get Casey's perspective today. So Casey, as you know, as I mentioned, just wrote an article for our newest issue of the Christian Research Journal, and so I want to ask him a little bit about it. So what first launched this particular conversation in the evangelical church about Adam and Eve?
Yeah, so I think that this conversation had been sort of brewing for a while, Melanie. I think that there have been various perspectives on Adam and Eve within the Christian community for a long time. But what really launched the current conversation was a 2011 Christianity Today cover story, where they covered this whole topic. It was titled, The Search for the Historical Adam and Eve. And that article basically highlighted various evangelical thinkers who accept modern evolutionary biology but reject traditional beliefs about a historical Adam and Eve.
Well, that is interesting. Now, I know in the past you have written an article for us about this organization called BioLogos that a lot of prominent evangelicals are involved in, and particularly a lot of prominent theologically conservative pastors. And that organization involves Francis Collins and has a particularly theistic evolutionist viewpoint. So tell me a little bit more about BioLogos for those who might not have heard of that organization.
Yeah, sure. And I should, to go back to your first question, actually, I probably should link this to BioLogos. That Christianity Today article in 2011 really highlighted and promoted some scientists and thinkers at BioLogos who, as I said, do not promote a historical Adam and Eve and really reject traditional beliefs about Adam and Eve. And so what is BioLogos? So BioLogos is a nonprofit organization that was founded by Francis Collins. Francis Collins, of course, is the famous Christian geneticist who helped head the Human Genome Project. And BioLogos was founded by Francis Collins around 2006 to 2007 for the purpose of promoting the view that standard evolutionary biology is fully correct and fully compatible with a traditional Christian viewpoint. And so what they promote is what we would call theistic evolution, or what some people call evolutionary creationism. And yeah, you're right. I wrote an article for Christian Research Journal a few years ago. I think it was in 2014 on BioLogos. Basically, they have all kinds of projects where they will promote theistic evolution to the public. They get a huge amount of funding. I think they get hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Templeton Foundation to basically bring in campus ministry leaders to very posh conferences in Manhattan, New York, to learn about the theistic evolution view. They have a lot of money and a lot of growing influence within the evangelical community to promote their view. And so I obviously disagree with theistic evolution. I personally am a proponent of intelligent design. We can talk about that more, but that is what BioLogos does.
So I'm curious about the kind of viewpoints they have and the attitudes they have towards Christians who might question, you know, standard Darwinian evolutionary models. And, you know, this is kind of just in the cultural zeitgeist anyway, because as I'm sure you have and a lot of our listeners have, it's become quite popular to see kind of the secular, I guess, tenets of beliefs on yard signs. And one of those tenets is, I believe in science. So there's an attitude there that Christians, perhaps who don't hold to this, really would reject science. So how do they look at people who would say that there is a historical Adam and Eve?
Oh, that's such a good question, Melanie. And yeah, I mean, I live in Seattle, Washington, where these yard lawn signs that say science is real are everywhere. Okay, well, what does that mean, science is real? I mean, I have a PhD in science, so of course I believe science is real. But the question is, do you believe that science is sort of a monolithic set of beliefs where if you question any of those, then you no longer support science? Or is science a method for seeking the truth? And sometimes there are different viewpoints within the scientific community, and it takes a while to sort of hash out, what does the data say? Where is the evidence pointing? And we follow the evidence where it leads. And sometimes scientists with the same data set and very smart people can come to very different conclusions. Well, what BioLogos essentially says is that it is the duty of a Christian to accept whatever the scientific consensus says on evolution, okay? And really, if you question the quote-unquote consensus when it comes to evolution, then you are bringing shame and disrepute upon the church. You're hindering evangelism. You're becoming an embarrassment to the Christian church today. And various folks that have been affiliated with BioLogos and the theistic evolution camp have said as much. I think that there was a theologian who was quoted in the Christianity Today article who said that if we are going to ignore what mainstream science says, then we have no right to expect people to listen to us when we preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. I think this anti-science, anti-evolution rhetoric typical of evangelicalism brings disrepute upon the Christian faith, and it brings unnecessary shame upon the name of Jesus Christ. So this is guy, I do not believe that he's affiliated with BioLogos, but it certainly reflects the views that we often see coming out of some of the theistic evolution folks and the folks that are aligned with BioLogos. Essentially, that you need to accept what the scientific consensus says in evolution, and if you're not doing that, then you're bringing an embarrassment upon the Christian church. Now, I always thought that the way that a Christian should approach evolution is that you should have the right to investigate this topic and think about it, make up your own mind, and follow the evidence where you think it leads. And if you think it leads to a pro-evolution viewpoint, okay, fine. But if you think that it maybe does not lead to a standard evolutionary view and you are skeptical of the Darwinian viewpoint, then I think that you should have the right to also hold that viewpoint. And unfortunately, BioLogos really takes a view that you have to accept whatever the consensus says. And this has led to some problems over the years, Melanie, because sometimes what they will claim is the consensus turns out to not be correct. And so what they've done is they've now actually been the ones who have hindered the progress of science by saying that you're not allowed to question the consensus, you're not allowed to follow the evidence and think for yourself and sort of be skeptical, which I think is what a scientist should be.
Well, it's interesting because culturally, anyone who would hold to the Bible being true, and particularly that Adam and Eve existed, is seen as very unthinking and not even naive, but just not intelligent at all. And so why is this true? Also, I find it very interesting of the theistic evolutionist camp because they're Christians. So why exactly did they start claiming that Adam and Eve never existed? Because that's a very interesting theological proposition, especially when we're talking about evangelicals who would hold to the fact that, you know, that Adam and Eve are necessary when we talk about sin. You know, how did sin come into this world? So I think it's very interesting that they're claiming that they never existed.
Exactly. So obviously, yeah, most Christians traditionally have held to a historical Adam and Eve who were the sole progenitors of all of humanity. Okay, this has been the traditional Christian belief on Adam and Eve for thousands of years. Of course, there's been a few different views that have been out there here and there, but what we just described, you know, historical couple who are the sole progenitors of humanity, Adam and Eve obviously ate from the forbidden fruit in the garden. This caused sin to enter the world. That choice to eat that fruit was not just an arbitrary thing. It was a willful rebellion against God. That willful rebellion is what we call sin. And then, of course, Paul has all kinds of theology in the New Testament where he says that basically Christ had to come to fix the mess that was caused by Adam. Adam's sin caused sin to enter the world. Christ comes. He's the sinless savior of the world, and he fixes the mess and the problem that Adam created. And this is very much part of both Old Testament and New Testament theology for Christians. Okay, fine. There you go. That's what Christians have believed. Well, what theistic evolutionists tend to, how they tend to approach the issues of science and faith is sometimes they will say they believe in a dialogue between science and faith, but to me, it really looks more like a monologue, where the evolutionary viewpoint is held as a fixed star that they're not allowed to ever question. And if that means that theology needs to change in order to accommodate an evolutionary viewpoint, then that's their first go-to solution to any apparent disagreements between science and faith. So what theistic evolutionists have done, especially some of these folks at BioLogos who were quoted in that Christianity Today article questioning the existence of Adam and Eve, what they've done is they've looked at human genetic diversity, okay? And so what they've argued is that modern-day human genetic diversity is so great that there is no way that we could ever have been reduced to a mere pair of individuals in the human population from which we all are descended. In other words, we see too much variation among the genes of living humans, and we can never be reduced back to just an initial pair of human beings. If you think about how many chromosomes or how many copies of each particular allele or gene exist in among two people, well, the answer to that question is 4. You have 2 copies of each gene in your body. They're called alleles. So basically, you have 2 alleles of each gene. You get 1 from your mother, 1 from your father. And then if you have a spouse, then your spouse also has 2 copies of each gene that they inherited from their mother and their father. So that's a total of 4 copies of each gene, 4 potentially different copies of each gene that every pair of human beings has. So Adam and Eve potentially had 4 copies of each gene. What the critics of Adam and Eve will say is that there's no way to reduce human genetic diversity back to simply an initial pair of people where together they had 4 copies of each gene. We see far more variation than that within the human population today. And so according to the standard evolutionary view, humans did not evolve from an initial pair. Humans evolved from a population of thousands of individuals, say up to 10,000 individuals. And it is this large population that's able to give rise to the modern high degree of genetic diversity that we observe in the human population. And so this is basically the argument against Adam and Eve, that evolutionary science says that we never came from just an initial pair of individuals, that we evolved from a population of thousands of individuals, and only that large population of thousands of individuals can account for the modern day human genetic diversity that we observe. This is their main argument against Adam and Eve. Of course, we can talk about whether that argument is a valid one or not, but that is the argument that they've made against Adam and Eve. And what they've said is, look, we're just going to accept whatever modern evolutionary science says. We're not going to question it. We're not going to ask if there's other ways to look at the data. We're just going to simply accept it as if it is the carte blanche truth, and we're going to modify our theology accordingly. So if modern-day evolutionary quote-unquote consensus science says that we never came from an initial pair, then we're going to accept that, and we're going to reject the idea, this biblical teaching that has been believed by the church for thousands of years, that we came from an initial pair of 2 individuals, and we're just going to accept that evolutionary viewpoint and modify our theology whenever it's needed to accommodate an evolutionary view. And this is sort of how the evolutionary camp, the theistic evolutionists, have responded to this genetic argument and what they think it says about Adam and Eve.
I want to tell you about a very special promotion that we're having to grow the subscriptions of the Christian Research Journal and get our magazine into more people's hands for Christians to be equipped, as we say in the tagline on our print edition, to be equipped in exercising truth and experiencing life. So we give you all kinds of articles that help you with Christian apologetics and doctrinal discernment, as well as articles that will help you grow in your faith and help you understand your union with Christ even more, including this subject that we're talking about today, about what it means to become older and what the Bible has to say about aging from a biblical perspective. And so here's how you can get a subscription, help us for our fiscal year end, and also to maybe give some subscriptions to friends, your pastor, or family members. And so if you go to this link, equip.org/product/journal offer, that's one word, journal offer, you will go to this landing page that will tell you that you can get a subscription for a gift to the ministry of $30 or more. And normally a subscription, as I mentioned on this podcast, is $33.50. You can get two subscriptions for a gift of $55 or more, three subscriptions for a gift of $75 or more, or four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more, and you would receive two hardcover books, one copy each from the vault of the Best of the Christian Research Journal. And so we have a book called What is Truth? And another book that's called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals. So for a gift of $100 or more to the Christian Research Institute, you will get four subscriptions and two hardcover books. Plus, all of the subscriptions, as you know, include access to our online exclusive articles that you hear me mention a lot on this podcast. So you would get all of the online exclusive articles as well as the print subscription right to your door. So please consider giving a gift to help us for our fiscal year end, as well as spreading out the information for the Christian Research Journal to family and friends, and maybe even church staff members that you attend. It's a really great equipping gift. And so again, the URL is equip.org/product/journal offer. Well, you were just talking about how those at BioLogos are very adamant about believing in the scientific view of evolution. And I find that curious because, you know, especially young students, they're going to say, hey, you know, I want to hear, you know, how can I think through my Christian faith, but also maybe accept some of the things I'm learning at my university, for especially for the kids that are going to go off to college in the fall. And so they'll go onto the BioLogos site, and at their site, they say they believe that the Bible is the inspired and authoritative word of God, and that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead, and we're sinners and we need Christ. So how does that jive with their rejection of Adam and Eve?
Well, let me say this first before I answer your question, Melanie. I mean, BioLogos has been a changing organization. They themselves have been evolving over the years. So some of their claims about Adam and Eve, they've actually softened over the last few years. And we'll get into this, I'm sure, during the conversation today about why they've softened their claims and where they stand today. But I think that historically, BioLogos certainly has taken this strong stand against Adam and Eve. And then you're right, they will make these claims on their website that sound very traditional evangelical. You know, we believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God. That is certainly what most evangelicals would also say. Well, as is often the case, you have to really read the fine print. You have to dig deep, see what people are really saying, and if what they're saying really does fit with a traditional biblical view. It's the same with a lot of Christian colleges today, Melanie. A lot of Christian colleges will, you know, when you're signing up to send your kids there, they'll send you brochures that make it sound like, oh, they believe in all kinds of traditional Christian views of sexuality, Christian views about origins and creation and Genesis, Christian views about all kinds of different topics. And then when you really dig into what they're teaching in the classroom, what kinds of activities they're promoting on the campus to the students, what kinds of viewpoints are sort of in vogue and really being promoted to the students, you find out it's very different from the brochure that they gave you during orientation week or during Visit Our Campus week. And so this is really a very common problem in evangelicalism today, and that people are trying to sort of, I would almost say, talking out of both sides of their mouth. They will say one thing to one part of the culture to make them sound very aligned with what where our culture is going, what our culture believes right now. And they will say another thing to the church, frankly, to make themselves aligned with more traditional viewpoints within the church. And I think that with BioLogos, there may have been a little bit of that sort of, you know, one message for one audience and another message for another audience. And that certainly is a problem. So you really have to dig deep into what people are saying and find out what they're really all about. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're just saying that it's kind of like they might have a message depending on the audience. So that makes me wonder, does this, you know, debate, which would seem like it's very much in the evangelical camp, has that ever gone to a wider audience in our culture? I mean, is our general culture aware of this debate about Adam and Eve within Christianity?
Yeah, it has reached the wider culture. And actually, let me say one more thing just to back up on your previous question about, you know, how is this impacting students? I don't want to name any names here, but I'll just say that someone who has been a very prominent voice against Adam and Eve historically from BioLogos, I had the opportunity to speak at their university a few years ago. And at the end of my little presentation, a student came up to me and said, "I'm so glad that you're here, because I want you to know something, that this professor is teaching a lot of views that go against traditional Christian beliefs when it comes to origins. And it's had a really negative impact on my friends who are students." And this was at a Christian college. I want to make this really clear. This was at a Christian university, an evangelical school. Okay, so this is certainly happening within, it's not just at secular schools where you can send your kids and they will hear messages that really challenge what you would think would be sort of uncontroversial traditional Christian beliefs. That can happen even at Christian universities. But okay, so let's get to your question. So did this evangelical debate reach a wider audience in the culture? Yes, it certainly did. In fact, going back to that Christianity Today article that I mentioned that sort of kicked off this debate in 2011, well, a few months after that article came out, there was actually a story in NPR. And NPR, with Barbara Bradley Haggerty, who was one of their religion correspondents, they did a whole story titled "Christians Divided Over Science of Human Origins," where they talked about the fact that there are now voices within the evangelical community who are challenging traditional beliefs about Adam and Eve and claiming that humanity arose from this population of 10,000 people and never, sort of the standard evolutionary view, and never arose from an initial pair of individuals. And in fact, I mentioned earlier that quote from that religion professor who was saying that, you know, if you question evolution, you're bringing shame upon the Christian church. That actually was also in the NPR story. This person was saying, again, that if we ignore mainstream science, we have no right to expect people to listen to us when we preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, and went on to say that they thought that this anti-science, anti-evolution rhetoric brings disrepute upon the Christian faith and unnecessary shame upon the name of Jesus Christ. So these sort of perspectives, these sort of attitudes have been promoted to the wider culture, saying that, look, we Christians, we want to look like we're in touch with what evolution says. We're not rejecting evolution. And when we do that, we're really going to throw our fellow brothers and sisters who do have questions and doubts about evolution, we're going to kind of throw them under the bus, and we're going to say that they're bringing shame upon the church. And I really think that that's not the right way to treat our fellow brothers and sisters who are following the evidence where it leads, and who think that they just hold a different view. I think we should allow Christians to have different perspectives on these topics. Another instance where this debate broke out before a wider church audience was in 2017, when a biologist associated with BioLogos named Dennis Venema and a theologian named Scott McKnight co-wrote a book titled Adam and the Genome. And that book, again, argued against a traditional view of Adam and Eve. It argued exactly what we've been talking about here, basically that humanity arose or evolved from a population of about 10,000 individuals. And that book put it very strongly. And this book was written at a very popular level, aimed at a very sort of popular readership, promoting the view that Adam and Eve could not have existed. And they went so far in this book, Melanie, to say that Adam and Eve are as decisively refuted by the data as the old long discarded geocentric model of the solar system. So basically saying that if you believe in Adam and Eve, then that is like believing that the Earth, that the sun goes around the Earth and that we still have this geocentric model where the Earth is at the center of the universe. And so I thought this was very interesting that they were taking a very, very hard line, almost condescending approach to Christians who believe in a traditional Adam and Eve, saying that they're no different than geocentrists, essentially.
Well, I think to some of our listeners, if they go explore the BioLogos website, which, by the way, fascinating, Barbara Bradley Haggerty is on their advisory council, is if you look at who's on their advisory council, you're talking about a professor from a very conservative evangelical college with a very, you know, prestigious, I guess, heritage. And you're talking about well-known writers from very conservative theological circles that are also on the advisory council. So that can send some kind of confusing messages and maybe make people think it's okay to consider what's being said there.
Oh, I think you're definitely right. They want to posture themselves as if they are conservative or traditional in terms of their outlook on these questions. And again, I want to make the caveat that BioLogos has actually softened this hardline argument against Adam and Eve in the last couple of years. Again, we'll get to that. So it's not quite as bad as it used to be. But what I'm saying right now has always been true with them, that they've tried to posture themselves as sort of, you know, fairly mainstream and conservative. What I would say that that's really not the case if you dig down to some of the views that they historically have espoused.
Now, I know that in the past article that you've written for us about BioLogos, you mentioned scientists who challenged arguments against Adam and Eve. And who were they and what did they say? What did they posit against that?
Sure. So there have been a number of scientists who have challenged these theistic evolutionist arguments against Adam and Eve. Some of them came from the intelligent design community, some of them outside the ID community. We'll start with some of the folks who are inside the ID community. One of them is a biologist named Ann Gager, who's a very good friend of mine and a senior fellow with Discovery Institute, where I work. Ann initially looked at some of these arguments that certain genes were too diverse to have ever been reduced to simply an initial, you know, sort of set of four copies of that gene, different copies of that gene. And what she looked at was what are called human HLA genes. They're involved in the immune system, and they're very diverse. And she was able to look at these, and she found that actually it is possible to explain modern-day genetic diversity of human HLA genes, even if we originated from just an initial couple. And she wrote that up actually in 2012 in a book that Anne and I co-wrote titled Science and Human Origins. So it's a great resource to sort of get the scoop on one of these sort of early arguments against the existence of Adam and Eve. But then in 2017, that book titled Adam and the Genome was published by Dennis Venema and Scott McKnight. And after that book came out and really forcefully promoting these arguments against Adam and Eve to very popular sort of evangelical readership, those authors, in particular Dennis Venema, was engaged on the BioLogos discussion forum by Richard Buggs, who is a Christian geneticist at Queen Mary University in London. And it was sort of a lengthy conversation that they had, but through this conversation, eventually, what Dennis Venema actually admitted was that some of the papers that he had cited in his book, Adam and the Genome, against Adam and Eve, had not actually addressed, much less refuted, the existence of an initial couple from which all of humanity had arose. So this was very interesting that Dennis Venema actually sort of admitted that, look, these scientific papers I'm citing, they're not saying that it's impossible for Adam and Eve, or not Adam and Eve, but for humanity to have been derived from an initial couple. It took a lot of argument back and forth to get him to admit that point. So eventually Richard Buggs, who again was one of these Christians who was a scientist who challenged these arguments against Adam and Eve, he wrote on the BioLogos discussion forum that he said, "You would do your readers a service if you wrote a blog to tell them now, as far as you're able, that present-day genomic diversity in humans does not preclude a bottleneck in the human lineage between approximately 700,000 to 7 million years ago. I think you owe this to them." So when Buggs is mentioning this bottleneck, what he's talking about is the idea that the human population was at one point reduced to just two individuals. It's essentially equivalent to humanity being founded by Adam and Eve. And Venema responded to Buggs, and we should, you know, praise Venema for this. He says, "I've already agreed with this. you're welcome to publicize it. So this is sort of Venema's way of saying, look, you're right. The data does not preclude the possibility that the human lineage was reduced to just two individuals at some point very far back in the past. And so Venema essentially at this point is acknowledging that his arguments have not successfully refuted the existence of Adam and Eve. And this is very, very significant. So what Richard Bug said at that point was that the question was no longer whether we could have had a historical Adam and Eve who lived, but when they lived. And in fact, Anne Gager had already started a project collaborating with a mathematician, a professor of mathematics at the University of Stockholm in Sweden, to address that very question. When could Adam and Eve have lived in order to explain modern day human genetic diversity? And they then published a series of three papers in the journal Biocomplexity, peer-reviewed papers, which basically showed that modern-day human genetic diversity can be explained if we are derived from simply a single pair of two ancestors, Adam and Eve, who lived about 500,000 years ago. So basically, they showed that it is possible to explain modern-day human genetic diversity from the data if Adam and Eve lived as far back as 500,000 years ago. And they found that that's sort of making an assumption that after Adam and Eve were created, that sort of just standard evolutionary processes took hold and sort of those governed the progression of the human species. But if you make some other assumptions, say about how many offspring Adam and Eve had, or did Eve, perhaps she was created, you know, when a young female baby is born, all of the eggs that she will have throughout her lifetime are already there in her body. So if you make other assumptions, like that Adam and Eve had many children, such as the Bible might suggest, over, you know, hundreds of years of living, or that maybe Eve was actually created with diversity even in the eggs that she was given at the time that God made her, much like a human baby, a female baby has all the eggs that she's going to have when she gets older and has children, even at the time that she's born. If you make other assumptions, you could have Adam and Eve living much, much more recent than 500,000 years ago. I mean, we're talking like maybe say just within 10,000 years ago or something like that. Another scientist who challenged these biologos arguments against Adam and Eve is a computational biologist named Joshua Swamidas. He did sort of a rough calculation on the biologos discussion forum and he posted it on his website that was very similar analysis to what Anne Gager and Ola Hoster found, namely that Adam and Eve could have lived within 495,000 years ago. So roughly the same result of Gager and Hoster that Adam and Eve could have lived about 500,000 years ago as our sole genetic progenitors. And there was another, and I should note that Joshua Swamidas, he's basically a proponent of evolution. He's not a proponent of intelligent design. But here we have essentially an evolutionary scientist who is a Christian who is also finding that these arguments from biologos did not refute the existence of Adam and Eve. I think that's very significant. And in fact, another theistic evolutionist named Steve Schaffner, who is very much aligned, I think, with a biologos view, he also looked at the data and came to a similar conclusion, that the data does not rule out the possibility that humanity could have arisen from an initial pair, you know, who we might call Adam and Eve. So I think this is very significant. These are all scientists, folks who are coming within the intelligent design camp, folks who do not consider themselves intelligent design proponents, but themselves are sort of proponents of the standard evolutionary view, but they're all Christians, and they all are qualified scientists who are finding that the biologos arguments against Adam and Eve were simply wrong. They did not refute the possibility that we arose from an initial pair.
So I do want to mention to our listeners that Anne Gager, who Casey has just mentioned, has written for us back in 2015. And if you go to our website, you can read her article for free. Now, I want to ask you about the new book that came out from William Lane Craig, In Quest for the Historical Adam. And actually, for some of our listeners, if you're new and you missed it, back in episode 277, I did a deep dive 1 hour on this book with Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe. But I do want to ask Casey about it too. Can you tell us again what he says about Adam and Eve? And again, it's one of those things because William Lane Craig is such a well-known, very, very brilliant apologist that you know, people would look to him to say, okay, how can I look at origins? And so is his view on origins something that Christians should consider?
So William Lane Craig's book, that's a great question, Melanie. William Lane Craig's book, In Quest of the Historical Adam, is a very complex book. He spends the first 200 pages looking at the book of Genesis and sort of the nature of the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis and whether they are what he calls mytho-history. Now, I'm not a Hebrew expert or an Old Testament expert. I'm just going to say that I found his arguments that Genesis basically has components of what we would call myth to be very, very weak and unpersuasive. Now, William Lane Craig is very careful to nuance his discussion to say when he says myth, he doesn't necessarily mean that that means it's wrong. But when you read the book, you actually find that he's saying that there are elements of the book of Genesis, which any reader would understand, even the author would understand, to be quote unquote fantastical elements that are palpably false. So that's what he's saying about various aspects of the book of Genesis. But I found his arguments that basically aspects of Genesis are fantastical or false to be very weak. And in fact, I think that they did not really take seriously many of the efforts that a lot of Christians have made to try to reconcile science and faith. But let's bracket that off, because what I was most interested in when I read his book, In Quest of the Historical Adam, was his sections on paleoanthropology. And basically, if Adam and Eve did live, were they historical persons? And where might we situate them in the fossil record? Well, he does come to the conclusion that the Bible teaches that Adam and Eve were historical people. So that is a good thing about his book, and I agree with that very much. And what he finds is that given that fact, it is possible to locate Adam and Eve in the fossil record, and he proposes that they might have been human beings that looked like something like the species Homo heidelbergensis that lived between 500,000 to 750,000 years ago. And of course, that view, I think, is plausible. I think that Homo heidelbergensis, if you look at this species in the fossil record, in many respects, it is very, very similar in the way it looks, its morphology, to modern humans. Yes, it did have a slightly smaller brain size on average, but well within the range of modern human genetic variation. And I see no evidence to think, at least from its skeletal morphology, that this species, Homo heidelbergensis, could not have been very modern like human beings. So I don't have a real problem with that proposal. I'm not necessarily saying it's true, but I think it's a possible thing that could be true. It's plausible, you might say. I don't have a real problem with William Lane Craig's paleoanthropological argument there. In that respect, sort of the paleoanthropology of William Lane Craig's book, I don't have a real problem with. It's more the biblical analysis and his argument that William Lane Craig is, that he's arguing that the Genesis parts of it are myth or claims that are actually false. I think that was much weaker part of the book than his aspects of the book dealing with the paleoanthropology. But can we go back to something, Melanie? Because I'd love to talk about the response, the official response from BioLogos to some of these arguments that Adam and Eve actually could have existed. Is it possible you could go back to that real quick?
Oh, yes. Please give us some insights on that. We would love to hear just a little bit more about that, because this is just a really critical debate, because I think that if Adam and Eve weren't real, I mean, that just undermines the entire gospel.
I agree. It's a real problem for, you know, taking the teachings of Paul in the New Testament seriously. Paul is very, very clear that Adam and Eve are real people. And William Lane Craig, also to his credit, looks at the New Testament and agrees that the New Testament and the Old Testament clearly teach that Adam and Eve were real historical people. So I like that part of his book. But yeah, going back to BioLogos, we did mention already how Dennis Venema conceded that really his book and his arguments had not refuted the existence of Adam and Eve. Now, in 2021, or by 2021, I should say, BioLogos had actually deleted from their website a number of articles claiming that historical Adam and Eve were impossible. And in fact, BioLogos' president, Deborah Harsma, acknowledged that their scientists had, quote, made premature claims that evolutionary science and population genetics rule out scenarios with a recent universal human ancestor or with a de novo created ancestral pair. And she went on to say that they had, quote, overstated scientific claims that unnecessarily excluded theological positions that are consistent with scientific evidence, unquote. So I want to say right here, look, everybody makes mistakes, and Dennis Venema and BioLogos should be commended for modifying their positions when warranted by the evidence. I mean, I think that, what we can see here is that essentially they're acknowledging that their previous arguments against Adam and Eve were not strong and were not good arguments. And so, look, yes, they got things wrong, but we should give some credit here to them that they were willing to admit they were wrong and sort of backtrack a few things here. So I want to give credit where credit is due in that respect. But again, Melanie, I think if we just leave it there, then we miss the lesson of what's happened here. We can get into that, but that's sort of, we missed this, what is the lesson we can take from the debate over Adam and Eve?
In your article, you talk about some Christians, you know, especially those who hold to theistic evolution, who will promote human-ape common ancestry by citing pseudogenes. So what are pseudogenes, and do you think that they make a good argument for common ancestry?
Yeah, great question, Melanie. And yeah, this is a very common argument that's still being made, even by the folks at BioLogos, that humans and apes share a common ancestor. And in fact, if you dig deep into some of the technical footnotes of William Lane Craig's book, In Quest of the Historical Adam, he's very open to the possibility that humans share a common ancestor with apes. And I don't think that he necessarily has a firm position on that, but he certainly expresses openness to that idea. And one of the pieces of evidence that he cites that he thinks points in favor of humans and apes sharing a common ancestry are pseudogenes. So what are pseudogenes? So pseudogenes are elements in our genome, stretches of DNA that look like a functional gene, except they have maybe one or a few mutations which prevent that stretch of DNA from producing a functional protein. Okay, so they might have something called a premature stop codon, where basically you cannot translate the RNA that is produced by that gene, that DNA strand. You cannot translate that RNA into a functional protein, or there may be some other mutation that prevents the gene from being transcribed into RNA, so it cannot then be converted into a protein at the ribosome. So there's some mutation basically that prevents this quote-unquote gene from being able to be used as a normal gene that can produce a protein, okay? And so a pseudogene, therefore, is often, people will say, it's a copy of a gene that underwent mutations that prevent it from being able to produce a functional protein. And what we find in the genome is that both humans and apes have certain quote-unquote pseudogenes that look almost identical. They'll be in the exact same place in our genomes. They may even have the same mutations that prevent us from being able to produce a functional protein. And so as the argument goes, God would, or no intelligent designer or God would never put the same sort of mutated broken gene in the same place in two different species because it has no functional purpose. And therefore the fact that we share this same broken gene in the same place in our genomes between humans and apes, it's the argument says that the best explanation for that is that we inherited that broken DNA, that broken gene, from a common ancestor, and that common ancestry is really the only way to explain why we share this broken gene in the same place in our genome as apes do in their genome. God would never put it there. It's evidence for human-ape common ancestry. Well, the argument hinges upon this idea that it is a piece of junk DNA, that it is basically a broken gene that is there not doing anything, that is actually functionless junk DNA. And so it's very much a junk DNA argument. So the problem with this argument, Melanie, is that is a whole body of peer-reviewed scientific literature that is finding that pseudogenes are not junk DNA. They are not simply broken genes that are a copy of a gene that have experienced mutations so that they no longer do anything. We're actually finding that pseudogenes can have very important functions, and that pseudogenes should not be viewed as sort of broken copies of a gene, that they actually are important functional aspects of our genome that are there for a purpose, and that they can have all kinds of different functions. In particular, one of the main things that pseudogenes can do is they can regulate the expression and the function of the protein coding versions of those same genes. Okay. So pseudogenes are very important for actually controlling when the protein coding version of a gene is expressed, when it produces the actual protein that it needs to produce. So to make a long story short, this whole argument for common ancestry based upon pseudogenes hinges upon pseudogenes being a type of junk DNA. But there's a whole body of scientific papers from top journals like Nature Reviews Genetics or Cell Biology or RNA Biology claiming and finding that pseudogenes actually are not junk DNA and that we should take them very seriously as important regulatory elements in our genome.
So where are we right now with this whole debate over Adam and Eve today, specifically in the church? Because you said that BioLogos has softened their view. And what lessons can we learn? Because again, it's not just, you know, well-known writers or professors, but also well-known pastors that are associated with BioLogos that can cause people to be confused about what they should hold to when it comes to origins.
That is exactly the question we need to ask here, Melanie, is where do we stand and what lessons can we learn from this debate over Adam and Eve? So there is this perception or there's sort of this stereotype that is being put out by BioLogos type advocates, people who are theistic evolutionists in the church today, that if you question evolution, then you do not have the right to do this. You are making the church look foolish. You're making the church look stupid. And basically, any time that Christians question an evolutionary viewpoint, they're going against solid science, and they're sort of using maybe a God of the gaps argument, because science is always going to be able to fill in all the gaps in our knowledge. Evolutionary science, in particular, is always going to be able to fill in the gaps in all of our knowledge, and that evolution is sort of the sacred cow that Christians should never touch, should never question. We should just accept it. Whatever the scientific community says, we should accept it and we should leave it at that. Okay. So that's sort of the standard view that's being promoted in many corners of the church today. But what this debate over Adam and Eve shows us, Melanie, is that sometimes it is proponents of evolution who can actually get things wrong. And sometimes it's actually the evolutionary viewpoint, the evolutionary consensus. It is the thing that can be wrong. Because in this case, what we saw is that evangelical scientists within the Christian church made very, very strong arguments that the science showed, the consensus showed that Adam and Eve cannot have existed. And those arguments turned out to be scientifically wrong. They were basically junk science arguments. And now, granted, they acknowledge that they were wrong, and that's very good. We should praise the people who admitted that they were wrong. That's wonderful. But the point here is that if we live under this sort of assumption that evolution is this monolithically accurate scientific view that Christians should never be able to question or challenge, then we're missing the point, because this whole debate over Adam and Eve shows us that sometimes it's actually the evolutionary science, the evolutionary arguments, and the evolution proponents, they're the ones that can be wrong. And so we should never come to the table with an assumption that evolution is always right or that evolution is always wrong. We should look carefully at the data, and we should be willing to ask hard questions, and we should allow people to follow the evidence where they think it leads. Okay, so that means that if someone thinks that the evidence is, you know, challenging an evolutionary view, and they have good arguments that are based upon science, we should take those seriously. It should be okay to do that within the Christian church. Of course, they need to be backing up with good data, but I think there is a lot of good data that challenges an evolutionary viewpoint. And in this case, the case of Adam and Eve, we found that actually it was the critics of these evolutionary arguments against Adam and Eve. Those critics are the ones who turned out to be right. So we have good historical precedent from this debate over Adam and Eve that sometimes it's the evolutionary arguments that are wrong. So that really is the lesson from the debate over Adam and Eve, that it is okay to question evolution sometimes. And in fact, sometimes it's the evolutionary arguments. Those are the ones that turn out to be wrong. Now, we can apply this lesson also to this debate over human common ancestry and pseudogenes, because we still have Christians who are saying, look, pseudogenes are sort of a knockdown, drag-out argument against the special creation of humans, that they unequivocally show that humans share a common ancestor with apes. But if it's the case that all this literature I cited from mainstream scientific journals, if all that literature is right, that pseudogenes are actually functional, then this whole junk DNA-based argument for human-ape common ancestry based upon this idea that pseudogenes are junk, that argument falls apart. And if pseudogenes actually are important functional aspects of our genome, well, then they're very easy to explain from, say, a non-common ancestry-based viewpoint, because what we could say is that, okay, these are now important functional aspects of our genome. And God could have a common design of the same functional aspects of the genome in different species, where it's a good design principle to actually reuse functional components in different species for similar purposes. So if God wanted to put the same gene or same DNA element in different species and have those fully functional gene aspects or DNA elements in different species, existing in different species in the same place for a purpose, then there's no scientific or theological problem with that. There's no reason why God can't create the same genetic elements in different species, sort of building them upon a similar blueprint and giving them similar DNA to perform similar functions. We call this in intelligent design, sort of from a scientific perspective, we call this common design, where it's a good design principle to reuse functional components that work in different systems, at different designs. So now it's very easy to explain pseudogenes because they're functional. They're not non-functional junk that is shared by different species. They're actually functional control elements in the genome, and they're shared by different species for a purpose, to perform the same kind of function. So yes, it is true that the consensus view of pseudogenes is that they are junk DNA, but we can find good evidence coming from the mainstream scientific literature to challenge that consensus view. And sometimes the consensus can be wrong. So I think the lesson we can take the lesson from the debate over Adam and Eve and apply it to pseudogenes and say, well, look, here we see the evidence is actually trending in the direction of pseudogenes being functional. I should add something else here, Melanie. One of the reasons why pseudogenes have been assumed to be functional is because nobody has been studying them. We know very little about them. They're sort of like dark matter in our genome, where they're aspects of our genomes that we know very little about. And this is because evolutionists, by and large, thought, oh, they're not producing a protein. They look like other genes. Therefore, they must be just, you know, useless junk DNA. So this evolutionary junk DNA mindset has led people to not study pseudogenes and just assume that they're non-functional junk. So this becomes sort of almost like a circular argument. Well, we don't know many examples of pseudogenes being functional, therefore they're junk DNA. But why do we not know much about them? Well, because we assumed they are junk DNA to begin with, and therefore nobody's been studying them. And we're just now, if you read the literature in the scientific community on pseudogenes, they will very often say, we're just now beginning to study pseudogenes for the first time, understanding what they do, understanding the important gene regulatory roles that they play. So we're really sort of at the very dawn of our understanding of pseudogenes and understanding their important functions in the genome. So again, this is not a good argument, I think, for Christians who want to argue for common ancestry if it's based upon an aspect of the genome that we barely understand and a lot of the data is contradicting, because the more we study pseudogenes, the more we're finding that they tend to have function. So I think that if we apply the lesson from the debate over Adam and Eve now to pseudogenes, that it's okay to question evolutionary assumptions, especially when the data is on our side, then we can make a good argument that these pseudogenes really are not functionless junk DNA, that they're important aspects of our genome, and they're not a good argument for human-ape common ancestry, as long as we're open to the possibility that God could use the same different types of genes and regulatory control elements that have important functions and put those into different species separately.
Do you have anything else you can share for Christians who are grappling with this issue about origins and evolution and even intelligent design? I mean, do you have any other tips for them? Because this is a big issue for people, and it seems like, especially for younger people, that they need to somehow accept the common view of, you know, Darwinian descent, or it's not really, you know, thoughtful to reject it, or it's not scientific to reject it.
Absolutely, Melanie. There are a lot of people, a lot of students who are under pressure right now to just accept the evolutionary consensus, to accept an evolutionary worldview. And if you go to a Christian college, there's even pressure to say, look, just accept an evolutionary viewpoint and try to meld that with your Christian faith. If it contradicts the Christian faith, well, then you can just sort of get rid of whatever Christian doctrines that don't fit with evolution. I'm telling you right now that if you're under those kinds of pressures, what I want to encourage you is that there is science on your side to challenge a standard evolutionary view. You just have to be willing to go and find that science. You may not hear about it in your mainstream biology classroom, but if you're willing to go and, you know, research this topic, read books by proponents of intelligent design, read websites like evolutionnews.org, Discovery Institute's main website, where we on almost a daily basis put out articles discussing the evidence for intelligent design and that challenges Darwinian evolution. Read books by ID theorists like Stephen Meyer or Michael Behe or myself with Ann Gager. Read books that are putting out good, solid science that allows you to find out ways to challenge an evolutionary perspective. If you're willing to put in the time and the effort to sort of educate yourself on your own time and learn about some of the scientific weaknesses in evolution, I can promise you that there are some very good arguments you'll find from the intelligent design literature that challenges a standard evolutionary viewpoint. So I guess the tip I would give to folks is to not be discouraged. If you're in a classroom and you're hearing that the evolutionary viewpoint is correct and it's really the only thing that smart people accept, that is not true. And in fact, there's now over 1,100 scientists who have signed a statement of dissent from Darwinism saying that they are skeptical of the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Over 1,100 PhD scientists have signed a statement agreeing with that statement that the standard Darwinian view does not work. And so you can be encouraged that there are credible scientists, there are peer-reviewed papers, and there's good scientific evidence that challenges an evolutionary viewpoint. And folks are welcome to go to Discovery Institute's website, evolutionnews.org, if they want to find out more about that evidence. Of course, they can also read Christian Research Journal is a great resource as well. Thank you so much for what you guys do, Melanie, putting out a lot of great articles on this topic and many others to equip people to understand the arguments against the Darwinian viewpoint.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid-fire questions for Casey. So, Casey, what's your favorite meal?
My favorite meal? You know, right now my favorite meal is the lunch that my wife just made for me that's next to me on this table because I'm about to eat it. I'm starving. But one of my favorite meals would be breakfast. I love to make eggs Benedict for breakfast or just cook up a really good scrambled egg breakfast. My wife and I do that a lot on Saturday mornings. We'll cook up a nice egg breakfast, again, eggs Benedict, something like that, and have breakfast in bed. It's a lot of fun.
Introvert or extrovert?
I would say extrovert.
Early bird or night owl?
Oh my. I'm a night owl who's trying to become an early bird.
And June is the month for graduation. So what advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
My 18-year-old self, it probably would have been to study a little bit harder and get better grades during college. I think I had a little bit too much fun, but I would say to just trust God, that he has a plan for your life. I mean, I am a Christian. I do believe that the God of the Bible is the designer. I've been a Christian since I was a kid. And I would say just to have faith and confidence that God does have a plan for your life and not to worry about the big picture things, that God is going to guide you and that he is going to take you through whatever hard times he has for you in your life.
Well, thanks, Casey, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to episode 294 of the Postmodern Realities podcast of the Christian Research Journal and the Christian Research Institute. Today's guest was Dr. Casey Luskin, and we have been talking about the debate in evangelicalism over the existence of Adam and Eve. If you would like to read his article and become a subscriber to our journal, his article is called Lessons Learned and Not Learned from the Evangelical Debate Over Adam and Eve. And our subscribers can read it in the new print edition, Volume 45, Number 1. If you're not already a subscriber, please go to equip.org.